So I'd now like to start introducing the panel. We've got Councillor Ketan Sheff, we've got Dr. Deli Ology Day, we've got Sharma Sagar Malik and Charlotte Bailey, and welcome to all of them. I'm going to introduce them separately just before they speak. So I'd like to introduce now Councillor Ketan Sheff. He's councillor for London Borough of Brent, representing Tockington, Wembley Hill and Wembley Park. First elected in 2010, and currently the chair of the council's Community and Wellbeing Scrutiny Committee. Ketan's a lawyer by profession and sits on a number of public bodies, including as the lead governor of CNWL and CNWL. Okay, over to Ketan.
Thank you, Judith. Wow, what a wonderful introduction. And thank you to your team for organizing this very important and timely event. So friends, Judith just mentioned sharing slides. I'm afraid I don't have any fancy slides to share with you, but I do have some interesting, I hope, words to share with you. So addressing and tackling health inequalities amongst our BAME communities is one of the biggest healthcare challenges we currently face as a society. There's no doubt that health gaps exist, and policymakers in public health and healthcare have identified some practical solutions. For example, there's been much discussion of removing what can only be considered as insurmountable barriers to accessing healthcare and other public services for marginalized ethnic groups, and that interventions really need to focus on improving access to healthcare and other public services. But friends, what I want to say today, and the key point of my presentation, is that a community development approach is one of the most fundamental ways in which we can address health gaps among BAME communities, and which has perhaps been overlooked. And I would like to suggest a few recommendations to support this community development approach. So you may ask, what does community development mean in practice? Well, I believe it could mean, firstly, encouraging and supporting communities to use their own assets to improve health and well-being. And secondly, helping communities and public sector, such as the NHS, to work in partnership to improve services, including how decisions are made about healthcare. I think this approach is appealing because it's based on inclusive values of social justice, equality, respect for diversity and culture. Also, it includes principles such as empowerment and collaboration with a view to making community development function effectively for all of us. Putting those principles into practice can be highly effective in helping to improve access to primary healthcare and other public services. It can also lead to improved health experiences and better outcomes for BAME communities, as well as reduce the current burden on the secondary care. So rather than concentrating all resources on improving access at GP practices, health policymakers should consider how this approach can assist in better health outcomes. In order to reduce the impact of health inequalities successfully, policy need to adapt to a community development-based approach, which could include, one, improving access as an outcome, two, user and community empowerment as outcomes, and engaging in partnership to achieve the desired objectives. So friends, in this part of my presentation, I would like to put forward some of my own recommendations based on my experience about this community development approach. First, recommendations for NHS commissioners. They could become more effective by One, developing policies based on community development principles, which I've just described. Two, applying the principles to existing initiatives to transform community services. Three, working effectively to offer more specialized services in a community setting. Four, working in partnership with local authorities to support capacity of the community sector. Five, writing tenders in a way that doesn't exclude the voluntary sector. And six, building flexibility into funding so that service providers can be more responsive to emerging needs. Now, recommendations for service providers. Community health centers can be learning points for community-based service providers, which could become more effective by one, implementing a multidisciplinary approach. Two, working in partnership with voluntary sector, who perhaps have better understanding of BAME communities and adopting policies to meet their statutory duties to eliminate discrimination and meet the CQC's core standards. And finally, recommendations for the voluntary and community sector. One, I think some work should be done to assess the effectiveness of the sector in addressing health inequality, improving health outcomes, and reaching those in the community that the statutory sector finds hard to engage. Two, to build capacity to ensure governance structures are robust and operationally functional. Three, provide primary care services by employing healthcare professionals. And four, make it easier for those outside the sector to engage with them. Friends, having set out my proposed recommendations, I would like to look at how they are informed by available evidence. So, there are clear and persistent health inequalities of our BAME communities. The Marmot Review in 2010 described that people with lower social economic status have worse health outcomes than those up higher the scale. Such issues, my friends, have significant implications for our NHS and in particular local access to range of health services. It isn't just poorest or most excluded who are at the risk of poor health outcomes, but everyone below the very top, or at least some to greater or lesser extent. Reviews of evidence show that most of the drivers of ill health relate to social, economic, environmental, cultural, and political factors that lie outside the immediate remit of our healthcare system. This is a key challenge for us and relies on true partnerships being built, developed, and strengthened. Differences in health of BAME groups are most evident in mental health, cancer, heart disease, and related illnesses such as stroke, HIV, TB, and diabetes. Additionally, an increase in the number of BAME older people is likely to lead to a greater need for provision of dementia services, as well as provision of culturally competent social care and palliative care. Inequalities in health based on ethnicity has been further highlighted in the recent crisis of COVID-19. Such differences are also evident across several risk factors for disease or disability, such as smoking, obesity, and lack of physical exercise. For example, there are higher tobacco consumption rates in Bangladeshi men in comparison to general population. As a local councillor, you may ask, what is the local government doing about bridging the gaps? Well, my friends, since 2013, local government has been responsible for public health and a specific role to tackle health inequalities, as well as improving the public's health overall. They are trying to maximize their contribution to closing the unjust gaps, even when resources are tighter. However, Westminster also has to play its part in reducing poverty and breaking the link between deprivation, ill health, and lower life expectancy. Friends, let me conclude by saying that moving towards sustainable and transformative community-based partnerships and a truly integrated care service is highly relevant and important in society today. The pandemic has shown us that healthcare and other public services need to be aligned to have a strong strategic focus on health inequalities, and all available levers should be deployed to ensure an effective response to health gaps locally. So friends, health is a community issue and one which cannot be ignored if we are serious about closing the gaps. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow, some really interesting insights about, you know, community development and really interesting point about cultural competence. Thank you. So I'd now like to turn to Dele. Dr. Dele Olajide is chair of the advocacy project, so we're very proud of him. He's former associate medical director and Caldecott guardian at the South London Maudsley, and was also staff governor too. So Dele, can I hand over to you, please?
Can everybody hear me now?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Judith, for the introduction. And also for arranging this amazing conference. And thank you to everybody who is attending. You could be anywhere else now, but you choose to join us for this very important discussion. What I would like to do is really go through history, how we began to where we are, and perhaps where we should be going in future. So historically, the NHS was created for one purpose and one purpose alone. That was to improve the health of the nation because of inequalities across the board. This was exacerbated by the war, Second World War. The country was devastated by the war, and the government decided, politicians decided, they need to rebuild the industries, they need to rebuild houses, they need to rebuild the infrastructure of the nation. How are they going to do it? Use citizens. But the citizens were all malnourished, were poor, they were not having access to health. Prior to 1948, when the NHS was created, people didn't have access to primary care. There wasn't a primary care. There were private GPs. There were private health care. And so the poor were not able to engage with health, were not receiving good quality health care. And so the NHS was born with one purpose, and that was to improve the inequality created by many, many years of us. Of government policy for that matter. And of course, it achieves the goal because people have for the first time free access to health from cradle to grave. And it is the envy of the nation, of the world, not just the nation, but of the world. And most people will now swear by the NHS because it provides something unique to for this country. However, as migrant populations arrived, first the Jews, and then the Indians, Asians, and then Africans, the Caribbeans, and so on, we have a group who were not part of the intention for the creation of the NHS. They were not factored into creating the NHS. And therein lies the problem we have today, that the NHS was not designed for migrant populations. Not designed for ethnic minorities, it was designed for local population. Why is that so? Naturally, because like the banking system, like every system that is designed in Western societies, they were designed for a certain group of people, usually the affluent, those who can access it, those who can afford it. So what you then have is NHS wasn't really providing for ethnic minorities. And so the debate has always been, how can we rectify what is essentially a structural anomaly? And I know when I came to the country in the early 80s, this was a big debate. How can we make NHS work for our local communities that were by and large affected by the inequalities, not just of health, but of the economy and social other social ills? So we have always thought we should develop a service that will be inclusive and provide for everybody. But how do we do it? Well, you can't provide a service for people who you don't understand. In the 80s, there were fewer foreign doctors who knew how to set up services. And as we have more and more foreign doctors, minority doctors, engage in the health service provision, they also became involved in developing innovative services for ethnic minority populations. So it's important for us to understand that today's difficulties were intrinsic to the system that was created, like in every other aspect of our lives. So what, if you were to ask, what are the causes, underlying causes of inequality in health? Well, the first thing to think about is we mustn't look at health as a standalone entity, but to look at health as part of the social, economic, political, and cultural entities of the society. This is, I think, the error we make when we talk about a provision of health for ethnic minorities. We think about health as a standalone. But the point is, none of our patients live in isolated lives. They are impacted by what goes on in the economy. They're impacted by what goes on in the education system. They're impacted by the politics. And they are, more than any group, actually impacted by these agencies of our society. So any attempt to create a service that would be equitable and useful for these communities, if they don't take on board the areas, the dimensions of health, these other domains, will not succeed. And in my opinion, that is why we have problems. Because we don't look at health as integral part of what goes on in a housing system, what goes on in education. If you should take mental health, for example. By the time the average patient reaches us in psychiatric services, they're already damaged. What are the causes of the damage? At home, you live in high rise, you have poor education, you have unstable health funding, income, and you don't have any access to all the things that make quality of life good. Then by the time you come to us, you are much more likely to be damaged. And so if we try to patch you up and treat people, we send them back to the same estate from which they come. Now, why did I use the example of the estate? This is not an accident. That's because we now know that most illnesses, whether it's mental health, whether it's physical health, is predominantly found in among those who are poorer people. So the poorer you are, the more likely you are to be affected by health inequality and health issues. The poorer you are, the poorer your access to healthcare, the poorer the service you are likely to receive, the poorer the outcome you are likely to have. These are built into the system. These are the factors outside of yourself, for the simple reason that you cannot access these resources unless you know how to do it. You go to the GP practice, for example, for mental health. We know studies that look at this. You go to a GP practice, you have 5 to 10 minutes to talk to your average GP nationally. If you have not told the average GP that you're suffering from anxiety or depression, chances are you will leave the GP practice without a diagnosis of anxiety and depression. You will not receive treatment for anxiety and depression. You will not receive access to psychotherapy. Those are facts. So the first issue for us, therefore, is targeting question of access. Chef, you talk about access, and I think it's quite critical, and I will talk about this further down the line. What are the attributes, what are the issues that cause difficulty in access? I mentioned poverty, but also we know there's class difference. The working class are less likely to be served by good health. We also know that racism in all its ramifications are predisposed to poor health. We also know increasingly that the media portrayal of minority people creates a lot of problem in the way they are perceived by society. And of course, we know recently the government's own hostile environment policy was designed to make living in England for foreigners difficult. These are factors that lead to poor health and difficulty in accessing health. Now, I would go so far as say that there is no health inequality that cannot be linked to a government policy in every Western society, not just in our society here, but in all societies. Policies designed by government can inadvertently cause inequality in health, and sometimes they're designed to cause inequality, not just in health. So if you are thinking of rectifying or alleviating these issues, then you must have the courage to examine how this can be alleviated, how government policies can change. Now, I worked in the civil service for some 4 years in the 90s, and I know that politicians look at communities in terms of votes. If there are no votes in a community, people don't particularly feel like doing much for them. And so how do we change that? Now, I know that is about 20 years ago. We now have many of our politicians, including our chancellor now, from ethnic minority. So we've made major progress in these areas, but there's a lot more to do, I think. So how do we rectify it? How do we make sure that inequalities are rectified? I'll make some proposals. One, let us examine how health inequalities manifest in mental illness. For example, looking at service pathways. So using the example of mental health, how do we rectify it? Historically, we rectify it by developing what we call culturally competent services. So people decide, we're going to, you know, mental health, the mainstream is not providing good quality care for us. So let us develop our own services. And there was a movement in the 90s and the 80s of services provided for and by people from ethnic minorities. They worked because they were relevant, but they died because they were not funded. One, they died because they became ghettos. Nobody wants to use them. So the next phase was, perhaps that's not the way to move forward, but to look at integrating and mainstreaming services. So that's where we are today, mainstreaming service for ethnic minorities. The question then is, how do we make sure that the needs of all our minority communities are taken on board. That, I would take put to you, is a challenge. So if you look at the services that mental health provide, where inequalities and also the potential to improve the services are available, they are the following: crisis service. Many of you who are in the audience will have had experience of one crisis or the other, either anxiety, depression, or based on family crisis. How many people find it easy to use a crisis service? Not that many. People struggle. COVID gave an example, gave us an example of that, how people were not encouraged to access service until they were so ill. And that in many ways contributed to the massive death of ethnic minorities. The intensive care service that we provide in mental health presupposes that people are so ill as to be nursed in high intensity care. But if you look at all intensive care services in London, most of the country, metropolitan cities, they are up to 70% are occupied by foreigners, immigrants, ethnic minorities. Why is that? Because they present in extremists. They present when they're in major crisis. And the treatment they receive there, most people will tell you, it's not something they want to repeat. They don't want to go back. They don't want to engage in their service as a result of that. If you look at acute care, any acute care service in London is full of psychotic patients. And again, up to 40 to 50% of inpatients in most London hospitals are ethnic minority patients. So we are failing our people for that reason, because they require such intensive and high level care services that constrain their freedom. And then, of course, forensic service, where in most parts of London, 70% of our resources are occupied by minority populations. So we've got to do better than that by providing services that will meet people at the point of their need in the community. We have developed in the past services like that, which look at domains of need of people, which looking at health, social care, education needs of the family, and providing those intensive support services across agencies. Those are the kind of services that benefit ethnic minorities, because ethnic minorities, more than any other group, require multitude of agencies to deal with their problem. So if you deal with it just as a single problem, you don't really survive and succeed in providing quality care and get adequate care, adequate outcome. I'll just quickly look at where's the future. Well, my view is it's not as bleak as I painted the picture of the past. The future can be bright. And one way to look at why service will be bright is to look at co-producing case records. We now have electronic health records in most trusts. That gives ethnic minorities a great opportunity. And one way to ensure your views are taken into account is through recording your own personal history in your records. Why is this important to co-produce your notes? Because artificial intelligence that are now being used in the NHS in using our data are based on machine learning of natural process language processing that we use. So your case note that your doctor writes is gone through by a machine that pick up words that are coded, that through algorithms design interventions, design your diagnosis. And so if you don't participate in that, you cannot influence your care, nor will you be able to influence your outcome. And most importantly, I predict that in the next 5-10 years, you will have your own case note in your pocket. you will be able to hunt for services within the NHS or whatever the service we have in the future. And so we'll have more control of our own care as minority population. And we also have the wide world web to look into. Before you go to see your doctor, you can hunt for your diagnosis. You can hunt for the intervention you would like to get and give it to your doctors and those who look after you. So in a broad way, this is how I see the future. And the future is a collaborative effort that integrates health with social services, with education, and with every aspect of our life, not as a standalone, but as an integrated whole. Thank you.
Thank you, Dele. Really, really interesting points, and really like the point you made about the importance of recording about you in your notes and taking ownership of that. Fantastic. Thank you. So I'd now like to introduce Sharma. Sharma is co-founder of Diversity in Public Appointments, the only organisation solely dedicated to improving diversity of representation in public office. Sharma's got 20 years plus experience of promoting and implementing diversity in the public sector, both nationally and internationally. And she's provided support and advice to boards and senior management team and ministers. So, Sharma.
Thank you. Thank you. And like my colleagues, absolutely delighted to be here with so many of you. And it's wonderful to follow Kate and Dele, because to be honest, it's like going back to, it's a Groundhog Day for me. It's going to start, well, I will be giving my age away, an indication of my age, because in the 80s, I was involved in the first pioneering project to look at how we can promote and actually action, not just promote, but action and work on what were then called multiracial healthcare and what we would now call working towards improving inclusive and anti-racist healthcare. And it's Groundhog Day, because I look at the stuff that Dele and Katyn have been referring to and all the reports that have come out subsequently, be it the Black Report in 87, the subsequent follow-up, the second Black Report it was called, the Marmot, and then the second Marmot report that followed on again. And they've all been saying the same things. So, and what it comes down to ultimately, I think as colleagues have already just said, is that ultimately the inequalities that we are seeing and that you're experiencing and you're having to support your service users and colleagues with, the cause of the causes, if you like, are systemic. It's in the institution, and as Dele said, it's built in to the policy, into the practices of how we operate. And I don't think we should ever lose sight of that. And yet also, just because I think it is important, as Kathryn has also mentioned, and indeed Dele, if we're going to really challenge and do something about it, we have to not lose sense and lose heart in our own sense of agency. And by that I mean what we can do. It's not just about responsibility. We're constantly being told we have to take responsibility. It's what can we do? Where are the spaces and opportunities that we have and that we can create individually and collectively to work in tackling some of that and keep on banging on that door? And just as a way of a quick anecdote, as I said, going back to 82 to 85, what's called training in health and race, we work from government departments right down to the front line of every single department. We, you know, instrumental in trying to raise the issues. And one of the strategies, I think one of the speakers saying, audience members saying, what can we do? What we did was we subverted from within. We were told to work with healthcare workers. We said, you cannot make the change and address the inequalities unless we empower and support and share what we are learning and hearing from you with them. They are our allies. So subvert from within is one of my messages to you today. But that's not what I'm being asked to talk about. So it's really about public appointments. And before I just talk about that very briefly, because that is a very important way of looking at policy into practice and holding to account, and I will come to that in a minute, I just want to take you back, again, as Caitlin and as Deli touched on this, that historical perspective, of what it says right at the top as the opening paragraph of the NHS Constitution. So just whether you are, you know, of a Black and minority ethnic origin background yourself, whether you belong to, in some sense, of a excluded group from or healthcare, think of that. Whether you are a healthcare or social care worker yourself, please think of that as a staff member. And whether you've been a patient, think of it from that perspective. Just, and I'd like you just to reflect on how much of this is the truth, okay? And what is it that I'd like to be able to think I could do? So the NHS belongs to the people. It is there to improve our health and well-being, supporting us to keep mentally and physically well, to get better when we are ill, and when we cannot fully recover, to stay as well as we can to the end of our lives. It works at the limits of science, bring the highest levels of human knowledge and skill to save lives and improve health. It touches our lives at time of basic human need, when care and compassion are what matter most. And even as I speak, and you know what? It doesn't matter how many times I say that, I get goosebumps. I am moved, I'm inspired, and I am frustrated. But I will not give up working on these issues, because that is a touchstone of what we're all committed to in different ways. And as we move forward in the transformation challenges of integrated care pathways, of health and well-being, commissioning, post-COVID, you know, what are the opportunities and lessons we can learn from that? I think there is something there of what is it that we can seize the moment in, and what do we need to stay alert from, never forgetting that history, because some of that is still with us as we come, those challenges remain. So where does public appointment sit? Sorry, I'm just going to go a little bit of pace here and assume that you have some familiarity because of time. Public appointments are, I want to use it a much broader way, but it has, in general, technically speaking, has a quite a narrow term. They refer to bodies, normally what we might hear as arm's length bodies or quangos, typically, that are supported and sponsored by a government department, but are absolutely critical in either setting policy, influencing and shaping policy, holding senior leaders and stakeholders to account. We've got colleagues here on board, so I mean, they're well placed, and I'm sure you engage with them in different ways. And then you will have other forms of public bodies which will do some of the doing on behalf of the bodies. So for example, like employment tribunals, health and wellbeing boards have them, people who work as lay custody visitors, prison visitors, and those kinds of things. So and then you have a whole broader remit of what I would just call public life, which is where people are involved as trustees, as committee members. So they provide a talent pool and a committed pool of people who are interested in engaging in, if you like, the general well-being, and not just the health well-being. So they're important for obvious reasons. As I said, they hold our managers who are delivering those services and the stakeholders to account. They can influence and inform about our lived experiences and what we think we need and what we know we need. And they can shape and influence what may be happening and needs to happen. So they are really critical, and they touch every aspect of our lives. And in that link, whether they're health related or not, I'll just bring you back to what the second Marmot report and the, you know, some of the post-COVID, well, and just COVID research has shown about the impact on BAME people and other groups that are socially, if you like, potentially excluded and unequal. That first thing to note is that in 2010, the second Marmot report showed that the amount of amount of time that people spend in poor health has actually increased since 2010. That's shocking. Shocking. And now, as I said, you look at what's going to happen with post-COVID and the long-term effects right across the piece, how economy, how education attainment, how digital poverty, all of those things, they will come and affect our health, if not of ourselves, of our families in some way. And not surprisingly, again, what the first report said was, as Della remarked, that reducing health inequalities is a matter of fairness and justice. So it affects us all. So public appointments, let's look at that. What is the state of play with BAME perspectives? There are over approximately 1,000 public appointments in over 550 bodies a year. There is an ongoing program. They don't all get recruited at the same interval, so, you know, as a rolling calendar. But on average, there is that's the turnover of new opportunities. Not all of them in health, I stress. They are responsible for spending or ensuring and overseeing spending of over £200 billion. Enough said. In terms of the representation of BMEs, it has gone down and down and down and down. And that's partly been through a lack of, I'm going to be blunt, in my opinion, government policy, not putting equalities and inclusion and a broader inclusive representation on boards high on its agenda, and very explicit, certainly in race, fell off the formal agenda of the priorities, as indeed disability, as did gender and LGBTI, and intersectionality is never really talked about, though it's beginning to be recognised yet again. So the latest statistics that came out in 2020, but they're for the year ending 2019, show that, I'll just speak to the general, at 31st of March, 9% of all public appointments were of BAME origin. That is down on 1% from the preceding year and substantially more from the year preceding that and the years preceding that again. In London, and you can look up the stats for your local areas because I know the audience isn't just from London, but I'm just being time efficient here, 43% of all staff are from a BAME background, but only 14% of the board level comes from BME, yeah? And that is down from 2018. All 36 London trusts have at least one board member from a BAME background, but that's again down from preceding years. So generally, I think what I'm saying is the trend has been downward. However, last year in June 2019, the government finally was kind of waking up, largely because communities were banging on about we are not being represented and we need to see that more equitable, was they produced a refreshed diversity plan, which took some insight and built on the Holmes report, which was looking at improving disabled people's representation in public life. So they have set a diversity plan for 2019, and the commitment, the stated ambition, it's not a target, it's an ambition that by 2022, 50% of all public appointments will be women, and 14% will be of Black, Asian and minority ethnic background. Okay, they also said, and how they're proposing to do this, and I think it's important because it's sharing this knowledge, is they are proposing to develop strategies that are about collecting more data and sharing that more transparently, rethinking how they're attracting that diversity of talent more generally, but particularly of BAME talent, looking at how the application processes work, and also looking at other more creative, innovative ways. Because the reality again shows that it's still a little bit of how it works in reality is a tap on the shoulder and the nudge, nudge of who do you know, and here's an opportunity. I'm conscious of time, so if I may just move on. I don't think I want to comment a bit more on why it's important, but I do want to share with you very quickly just headlines of why what makes it difficult, and then move on to what can we do, and you know, what might be some of the asks that you have. Why, back to this little bit, Groundhog Day, and what is it they're saying, the boards are saying, or we are saying as communities, makes it difficult? Lack of knowledge in the communities, or access about how the system works. What are you looking for is still an issue. What is the evidence that you want from me that I have it? Okay, so this is partly racism. This is about how implicit biases, about how we value and what we value. Is lived experience valued more or less? And it's interesting because one of the shifts that's definitely come through is, I believe very strongly, there's been a decreasing value of the lay perspective, of the lived experience and the patient perspective on the boards. Yeah, and we are being put more onto lived experiences, experts, but not where it comes to shaping policy, where the money comes in, whether you look at CCGs, whether you look at, you know, how STP plans are, I see the integrated care plans are being produced. So there is something about what are you looking for, and you know, what are you judging as relevant and desirable and essential? There is something about as I said, evaluating that, and the processes by which they've changed. The recruitment has absolutely shifted. There used to be an appointments commission, that is now gone. So you really need to be alert and hunt more specifically. It's been delegated a lot more to NHS improvement and to local boards. So the pathways, there's little evidence and information about how can I build my evidence, my skill set, that I can actually apply. So I may be in a committee today on mental health charity or a disability charity, or working on, you know, with refugee and migrant women, or on young people and education attainment, and I know mental health is an issue, how can I get involved? So there is that sort of lack of intelligence. So this is where we can all come together. And then there is just the whole recruitment process. And I will not lie, it is very competitive, very competitive. And another aspect that is fundamental for some public appointments, not for health boards, but for some public appointments, remuneration and the amount of time commitment that's required is actually very difficult. You know, if the meeting's all in the daytime and you're not getting paid or getting paid very little, how, you know, can you commit to that with everything else that you need to sustain in your own well-being? So I guess what I'm saying is there are lots of systems issues, there are knowledge issues, and then there are collaborative issues. There is also about knowing who can I reach out to and where can I connect with, who can I connect with, how can I keep myself informed and build, as I said, my knowledge, intelligence and agency. So to summarise, I don't think there's a doubt that we need to get more involved ourselves individually and supporting staff and colleagues in becoming more involved in public life that touch on health, whether it's through community health engagement, whether it's through specific health activities that if you're a healthcare worker or a social care worker, or you have some other leadership position, or you're in charities or voluntary organisations. So what can you do? What you can do, I would suggest, are some of the following, and I throw them down partly as challenges, as food for thought. And they're not in any particular order. However, having said that, I think first of all, wherever you are, whatever role you have, actually think about what can I do to demand and how can I demand and monitor more local accountability. All right? Whether it's in your team, whether it's on your board, whether you're sent the next plan out, whether you're with a voluntary organisation, how can you up the local amount of accountability of what's being done? Two, that might be asking questions like, what are you doing for the BAME community? Yeah. How are you including us? Not just representing us, because we can be represented, but not included. So what are you doing? What are you really doing? Third question. Show me the evidence of the difference it's making. Next ask is, keep on showing me. Don't just give me the annual report, keep on showing me. And then the last way is not what can I do to help, it's how are you going to help me to contribute? Yeah? How are you going to help me to contribute? So that's some of the stuff about accountability. I think the next kind of thing you can think about is if you are a BAME member of staff in any of those organisations working around health, get some mentor, get some support, form a network loosely across organisations. You know, you don't collaborative, cooperative working, we know the power of that. Start doing that informal networking to find out what's happening, do some assessment and get some support and getting some asking, not just for yourself, but about growing your knowledge and understanding of the issues. And becoming involved. Look at what's available to be involved in within your organisation to share some of that lived experience, not in a way of, you know, stressing you and being having your brains picked, but actually because it's about being valued. I think the third thing, just out of four, is that if there are any events, or start organising some events. It can be small. In your community, which is back to this, Katie was talking about, you know, community development, sharing what we know. So finding out, you know, are there a few people who'd like to be interested in now moving and stepping up into a higher role, but they're not quite sure what that means, how it would look like, what it might involve. Start getting that together. And we will be, you know, I'm happy, and I'm sure the Advocacy Project Delhi, any of us, you know, can share with you some of those experiences, and I'm sure you have some to share too. Which brings me to my last suggestion, which is an ask, really, and an offer. If any of you are interested in trying to explore the ideas of trying to maybe organise some local events or create a little bit of a database of people who are feeling ready to rise up to the next level of a public appointment, or who I think they might be interested but are not quite sure, yeah, please let us know. And I think I discussed this with Judith before, if you can contact the Advocacy Project initially, we will then gauge the level of interest and see between ourselves what, if anything, we can do to support you and or connect you into more local networks and give you some practical support about how to start doing more of that. Yeah. So raise the volume, raise your volume, raise your presence. Don't wait to be invited to the party. Subvert from within. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharma. Subvert from within. I think, you know, diversity in governance is just so important in terms of influencing policy and delivery of healthcare. And you made some great points about the value of lived experience as well. So thank you. Right, I'd now like to introduce Charlotte. Charlotte Bailey is the Executive Director of Organisational Development and People at CNWL, and she was previously Director of Strategy, Partnerships and People at Birmingham and Solihull Mental Health Trust. She worked in the public sector for 20 years, and has led major change programs, including for organizations like the World Food Programme. So Charlotte's going to show some slides now. She's showing a summary version, to fit with Zoom, but there's a full version of the slides with a lot more detail that will be sent out afterwards. So I'm going to hand over to Charlotte, and my colleague Frances is going to share the slides.
Thank you, Judith, and hello to everybody. And it's sort of quite nice going last, actually, because what I'm going to be doing is sharing some examples from Central Northwest London, the trust where I work. And as I was listening to my colleagues speak, hearing Keaton talk about community engagement and community development, I thought, well, yes, you know, we're doing some things at Central Northwest London that we need to be proud of in that space. Listening to Delhi talk about patient access and some of the things that we're doing around looking at our data in terms of access to services. And then latterly, listening to Sharma about public bodies, accountability, action and transparency. So I'll talk a little about our work there. So in terms of Central Northwest London, who are we? What are we? So we're actually a very large trust. We're the seventh largest NHS trust in the UK. and we provide mental health services, community services, and specialist services. So specialist services cover areas, things like forensic, eating disorders, children's services. So a range of services. But we also have a role in supporting the population and population health care. We serve a really large geography. We cover 3 million people. We operate from 120 sites and deliver from people's homes. The majority of our workforce is clinical, so 63% of our workforce is clinical, but we also have allied health professionals, social workers, we've got 170 apprenticeships, 160 volunteers, we've got peer support workers and many other professionals. And we work in conjunction with other health professionals and public services and with our communities, and we pride ourselves in the ways that we work in terms of co-production. So that's just a little about who we are as a trust. If you could move on to the next slide, please. I don't know if you're, thank you. So I wanted to talk about Central North West London's approach to what we do to reduce inequalities. And we take an approach that not just thinks about health inequalities and the communities and the patients, but also the staff within our organisation. So in terms of our role as a corporate, our corporate social responsibility, we take both that approach to our staff and reducing inequalities within our workforce, but also with our patients and our communities. And we see it as two sides to the same coin. So if you think about some of the things that previous speakers have said about health inequalities and deprivation within communities, now if that is then reflected in workforce statistics, how are we actually helping to reduce the inequalities within a community? But if in a workforce, we can actually ensure that our local communities are part of our workforce and are supported to become part of our workforce, then actually we are taking that role to support the reduction in health inequalities in those communities. So Sharma actually made the point of boards and representation at boards. So we have two leads who are named directors for our boards. So there is absolute accountability. So I take a lead for reducing workforce inequalities, and Robin Duran, our chief operating officer, takes a lead at our board for reducing health and patient inequalities. So there is an accountable and named person at board level to ensure that we both challenge at board, but also are accountable for what we're doing within the organisation. So if we can move on to the next slide, please. The populations that we serve at Central North West London, some of you will be aware of who we are and the populations that we serve. But as I said before, very diverse and highly diverse across the areas. And there's a range of deprivation. And you can see in that bottom text there that Westminster, Kensington and Chelsea, Hammersmith and Fulham, Ealing and Brent, some of the most deprived areas within the country. And the inequalities in life expectancy, particularly health life expectancy, are very high in Camden, Westminster, Kensington and Chelsea, and significant in our other boroughs. So we serve very diverse communities, and we therefore know that we have not just a role for our staff that work with us, but for the communities that we work and serve. However, and you know, this is something we're working on, if you talk about our workforce and who we employ, so of the 7,653, 44% of our workforce are BAME staff. So 44% BAME staff. However, of those, 22% are only in higher grade jobs. So we use a banding in the NHS, and it's called 8A, 8BC. So those are the more senior roles, and only 22% of our BAME staff are in senior roles. So actually the inequalities that we've got, and that's not just us in our trust, that is common across the UK in other trusts, doesn't represent the communities that we serve. And we have some inequalities within our workforce to do with the amount and numbers of BAME staff disproportionately in disciplinary procedures and applying for jobs and the rate at which people have an uptake from interview into job. So we do what we can to understand where these inequalities are within our workforce and look at taking action about what we can do. So like I say, we look at both the workforce and our communities. We can move on to the next slide, please. First of all, I want to talk about some examples of things that we do from a workforce point of view. And I think this does reflect some of the calls for action that Keaton, Deli and Sharma were talking about. I'm not saying we've got it right by all means, and we constantly learn and constantly take feedback to improve. But these are just some examples of things that we do. So in terms of that leadership element, and Sharma was very much talking about the diversity of the boards reflecting the communities we serve. And we continually to work to ensure that our board reflects our community. It's not there yet, but it is looking, you know, to improve. And we have recently recruited. So we are now much more diverse as a board representing our communities. But also the visible leadership that we play as an executive team is really key to ensuring that we advocate from the top of our organisation about what we do for our workforce and communities around reducing inequalities. And as I say, we've got named executive leads on our board. We do a range of things. So we support our leaders to develop in cultural competency, understand what inclusive environments are, and we support their development to make sure they have got the right capabilities, competences, values, and create the right ethos and culture within our organisation. We also make sure that we've got key staff from our BAME staff network who represent at committees and can challenge and can have a voice in, as Sharma was saying. So just last night, I was at Workforce Committee and Ela, our chair of our BAME staff network, was at committee with me, challenging some of the things that we were saying and asking for further movement on other things. So we really listen to our BAME staff network, but also get them very engaged and actually have a role to play at our most senior meetings. We also ensure that we look at developing key staff to have the most critical skills to be able to challenge us. So something called a RES advisor, workforce race equality standard. So actually they are trained to challenge us as an organization and making sure that we are delivering the best standards that we can deliver in terms of race equality strategy. We have things like a White Allies program, development and support program, and we publish our data. And again, Sharma was saying that's not just annually. So we've moved from just publishing annually to actually publishing our data on a monthly basis, both to Workforce Committee and to our board. So much transparency in the data. So leadership is one of the areas that we really make sure that if we invest there, that has an impact, not just throughout our organisation, but into our communities too. In terms of culture, we look at actually how we can create a psychologically safe, inclusive culture that reflects our values. There's some things there that I've already mentioned. I'm not going to read through those, and I know we're short of time. So, but culture is critical to people feeling. Now it's come up on my computer that I'm muted by the host.
No, you're not muted.
Oh, right, it's just come up. I've been muted.
Strange. No, we can hear you.
Carry on talking and people can't hear me. So it's really important to us that people feel safe, feel secure. Not only can they speak up about experience, but we use that experience to learn and to grow and develop and improve. And that's critical to how we mature as an organisation. We also make sure we take action. So listening to our staff, listening to our data, understanding where our gaps are, understanding where our inequalities are, and taking action to address those. So for an example of that is in our recruitment process. So BAME staff moving from interview and not into jobs, we recognise perhaps there was bias in the interview recruitment process and taking action to address those types of areas. So that's examples of what we're doing within the workforce. Moving on to the next slide, the things that we do in terms of as an organisation with patients and communities. So the role that Keaton was talking about community development and engagement, we have a big role there. We really understand sort of the determinants, the wider determinants of health. So whether that's jobs, finance, social networks, whether that's quality of housing, access to leisure facilities in an area. So we take a view that whilst our job is in mental health and community provision of services to keep people well and stay well, actually we have a wider responsibility for that population, healthcare management, and take an active role in that. So we have things like a recovery college where our patients and our communities and our staff can come together and learn together. We have schemes where we do community engagement and we go out into our communities and work in co-production with them around solutions. We target work in disadvantaged communities, and we do specific projects and programs of work to help people into employment, not just in the local area, but into our trust. Maybe that's through volunteering, peer support, into internships or into jobs within our community. We go out to schools and we talk to young people about coming into the NHS and working in our community. We are developing our approach to being an anchor institute so that we have that role within our communities to support those wider determinants of health. We offer our services in a very integrated way. As you can see there, multidisciplinary teams working with others, working as part of the communities and with the communities. And in terms of our patients, looking at that access, looking at those pathways, and ensuring we're paying attention to the data that shows where there might be inequalities, and again, taking action to address those. So I wanted to end by just showing an example of a piece of work that we've been doing very recently in Brent. So if we move on to the next slide. So sadly, Brent during COVID has had a high casualty rate, and Church End in particular, with over 45 members of the community dying as a result of COVID. It's hit the community hard. We asked ourselves, what role could we play as part of supporting that community at that time? To stay safe, to support them with any grief, bereavement, fear, anxiety. We didn't have to. You know, our organisation role is about commissioned services, but that bit that other colleagues were talking about playing that broader, wider role, working with communities. So going in, we talked to our mental health teams, met with the Somali community leaders and held discussions and listened to the leaders and what was needed in the community. And together put a programme of support around social distancing, public protection, hand hygiene, making masks together. And then what we could do is support to bereavement counselling and grief support. So taking an active role with our communities to support them as a social responsibility as an employer to support that community. So I just wanted to end with that as an example of practice. Sharma also talked about publishing the so what factor. It's all good and well taking action, but so what? And one of the slides that you'll get in the pack talks about our RES data. And sadly, we're not moving forward as fast as we want to, but we have seen increases in the number of our BAME staff moving into appointments from 8A and above, the reduction in disciplinaries and other factors moving forward. And we publish those statistics regularly. So thank you, and happily as part of the panel to move on to take questions.
Oh, thank you very much. That was really, really interesting and really good to see, you know, the practical steps that you're taking. But I think some really interesting points about leadership, transparency, accountability and culture. That was brilliant. So thank you. So we'll move to questions now. Questions have been coming in thick and fast through the talks, and some people sent some questions ahead of time. So please do keep the questions coming. What I'll do is I'll read the questions. I'll direct them to a particular member of the panel, but if any other colleagues on the panel want to chip in, please do so. So first one, I think for Ketan, around digital divide, there's some questions in the chat stream about, you know, with COVID and the future of health and social care seems to be a lot more virtual, seems to be a lot more online. Does the digital divide, do you think that's going to make health outcomes for BAME communities worse, and what could be done about it?
Thank you, Judith, for that. A very interesting question. And I think as a councillor, I see this in my councillor role, that there is absolute digital poverty. And I think what COVID has shown us that now that we are moving to some degree of normality via various digital platforms, like the one we are now on, Zoom and Teams and several others, obviously it is not available to everybody. And not just that, when we had the school closures, I think many children found that they were not able to be engaged. And I think accessing primary care and other aspect of the health of health and well-being of via digital platform is obviously very good, and it must continue. But I think we need to find a way where we are able to ensure that no member of our community is left behind, whether they are of a younger generation or older generation. We have to ensure that we are carrying all of our community members on that journey. It's not just digital poverty. Of course, there are other issues with digital offer. There are language barriers, perhaps. There are Wi-Fi and accessibility issues as well. It's not as simple as providing a gadget to a family if they are not able to then connect to that gadget. So I think, as I was trying to allude, as I was trying to show in my presentation in a very small way, that it takes a whole lot of different stakeholders within our community to come together, work together to ensure that there are various opportunities where we are able to bridge that gap, close that gap. And I think we will all have to up our games, local government, the NHS being the two key stakeholders who obviously have that much more connectivity with the local community. But I think the central government has a massive role to play in ensuring that whilst they are moving forward with this pandemic journey, that there is adequate resource provided within the community setting, within the voluntary sector, within the statutory public sector, to ensure that this bridge is very quickly filled. And I think the government were making the announcement that the pandemic is not likely to be over any day soon. And perhaps the virus is going to be around for some time yet, particularly with the winter around the corner. We normally have the flu season, but this particular season, we are going to be adversely challenged with the pandemic. And I think we really do need to up our game very quickly with the offer, with the resources backed off offered, so that everybody in the community is taken on that journey.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Question here, I think, for Sharma and possibly Charlotte. There's a number of questions have come in about perceptions, negative perceptions, stereotypes, reducing the seriousness, all the weight with which certain people, certain communities' voices are heard. I guess the label for it is testimonial injustice. And I think there's a number of questions that are thinking about the link between testimonial injustice and health inequalities. Do you have any thoughts or observations on what can be done about that culturally to make sure that people's voices do get heard?
Happy to start, Sharma, if you want me to. And for me, this is absolutely around the heart of great engagement and great communication and what Keaton was talking about earlier about sort of community engagement and community development. So actually, if we work in close contact with our communities and actually our staff are from backgrounds that reflect those communities, and we create ways that are safe to be able to listen, not talk at, to listen to communities, we're able to hear critical messages. We also talked a little bit about sort of not just listening, but actually our communities being part of our panels, part of our governance, and part of our cycles of challenge and support. So there's that co-production and joint delivery element to it as well. Just as some examples of listening. So I worked with our BAME staff network to understand from them directly what COVID meant for them in terms of being an employer. And they then went out and helped me talk to other people using ways, whether it was digital, face-to-face, you know, talking in groups, talking on social media, talking within communities, that they were able to support those channels of engagement to ensure that those voices came through. And the lovely thing was they brought me back stories. So it really brought it to life. So the testimonial, the experience that people had was brought to life through a staff story, some of which we read out at our board, and we use a staff story at each of our boards, at the start of each of our boards as well. So that's just a little from me about, you know, what we do and how we go about it.
Thank you. Super. Sharma?
Yes, great to hear some of those examples there, Charlotte. I think just a few reflections, really, and some of them I'm still kind of grappling with and some of them I haven't changed. So again, in no particular order, I think first of all, there's the whole thing about the power of language. So we talk about testimonial justice, we talk about data, we talk about stories, we talk about evidence, we talk about, you know, intelligence from data. So I think the first of all, if to me, it comes back to is what is our intention? How are we framing the value of that? So about testimonial, how is that different from evidence, or is it another form of evidence? And where are we kind of ranking it? Because that does affect it about how we see that. So the lived experience of patient experts is absolutely testimonial justice is there. When we talk about, if you like, the Grenfells or the recent inquiries into the, you know, COVID deaths amongst Black, Asian, minority and other communities, or in, you know, and just generally how we kind of valuing that. So there is just something there about language. I think there is always something about what level are we gathering these testimonies at? You know, is it national? Is it local? Is it day to day? You know, what level are we picking up the stories and testimonies? And what are we doing with them? Where are we taking them? You know, so it comes to the point of intentionality, because certain communities, I hear it time and again, we are tired of telling you our stories. We're tired of sharing some of the same testimonies. And that's not to devalue that, because it needs to be heard and heard again. What is your intention with what I am telling you? The hope I have is in the commonalities that if you are, it's, are you listening versus hearing? Because if you're really, really listening to me, you are going to both, whichever side of the table you're on, whichever side of the story you're on, you have to be prepared to be vulnerable and to admit, you know, this isn't right. And to hear with not just the open heart, but with openness. And that takes a lot of courage when we have, you know, public scrutiny, we have fear of, you know, anything from litigation to a personal being challenged, I did my best, whatever. So part of that just culture, part of valuing our patients, showing compassion, you know, it's that whole range. So there is something for me about listening versus hearing. And I think the last thing, which I suppose it comes down to as well, is safety. How safe is it really? I work a lot with, not just on public appointments, but with organisations going through change in the health service. And I've worked in the Nightingale. I can tell you, you know, it doesn't matter in the London Nightingale, whichever hospital, whichever context of change you're in, there are levels. People always need to feel safe if they're listening and or they are doing the listening. It's an uncomfortable place to be. It's a vulnerable place to be. Whose voices are we hearing? And I think when you hear the testimonies, don't devalue it, or slow down and also ask yourself, whose voices am I not hearing and listening? Yeah, and that is important. So I may be talking as an older Asian woman, but whose other voices have you not taken into account?
Yeah.
And that's, pause there.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And one for Delhi here. And it's around cultural competence. I think that's been mentioned a couple of times today, but there's also quite a number of questions about how to make services more holistic, more reflecting the whole individual, whole individual's needs, and that issue about intersectionality. So, you could share with us on that.
Sure. I spent about 30 years developing cultural competency, not only for staff, but for patients and for services. Now, what do I mean by that? Again, go back to the 80s. In the 80s, people talk of cultural awareness training. Now, anyone who's ever sat in a cultural awareness training, we know you've been mugged after 30 minutes, 1 hour of cultural awareness. You leave the room feeling somebody's got at you because you are racist, you are evil, you are nasty. And so it had the opposite effect for which it was designed. Cultural competency, on the other hand, is about developing skills that will make you competent in working with people from other culture than your own culture. None of us is conversant or competent in every culture. We need to be sensitive, we need to be aware. The beauty or the benefit of cultural competency is that it can be measured, it can be evaluated, it can be looked at and rated so that people train in the use of language, for example, in making sure the impact of the service they provide is relevant and beneficial to the community. Now, by the way, it's not just political issue, it's economic issue, because when you provide services that are not taken up and have poor access, it's of no economic benefit to the organization. So in order for your service to be relevant to the local population which you serve, it's got to be relevant. And in order to, if it's relevant, it will be taken up. And if it's taken up, you will justify your existence. But of course, the problem is, do people really want to take the responsibility for this extra mile? So cultural competency requires that you as staff and your organization, through organization development and an engaging community, learn to become aware of what is relevant in your community, what services they need. And you don't get that by asking them to come to your hospital to have a conversation with the board, by the way. You get it by going to the community to work with them, So organization development is about you, the chief executive, the OD director, sitting with the illiterate, the unemployed person in your community, asking them, what does it mean? What do you want? Because when you look at what we did in the 90s, what we found was the local services, NHS services, are irrelevant to our local people. They go to churches, they go to mosques, they go to community development services for their services. They only come to us when they are very ill. So you find in King's College, London, which is a major center for acute care, ethnic minorities in Southwest London, Southeast London, and West Southwest London avoid it like plague, unless they are ill. So you find things like fulminant cancer of the breast, cervix, don't turn up until people are extremely ill, because they don't feel comfortable going to those services. But they will go to church, they will go to mosque, they will go to anywhere else but. And the same with mental health. People avoid psychiatric services like the Maudsley where I was for many years. So the issue of competency really is that a service need to take into account local idioms of distress, for example. How do people express their distress in the Black community, for example, Africans, Caribbeans? It is not just the English language that people use, but the cultural tone associated with the language they use. And the average provider doesn't understand that unless you go outside. So if you want to really develop services that are culturally competent, you need to go out there. And it's not enough to use the same people who come to you with the idea of service change. Because service change is not static. It's constantly changing. And you discovered that through the COVID. The problem with COVID, you said you went to the church after people died. No, you should be going to the church before they died. How do you do that? Once it became clear that COVID was going to devastate society, we should be going to the churches. We should be going to local services and asking them, do you understand what this means? How can we help you? How can we collaborate with you? That is a culturally competent service. That is a culturally competent organization. And I think that is the message that we need to be putting home to our people, to those who work. Not only those who work within the service, but those who also are providing the service. And the last point I want to make about cultural competence is that patients also need to learn the language of discussing their distress. It's not enough to say the doctor didn't hear you or didn't understand you. It's critical that you also know what buttons to press, because doctors, nurses are human beings. They belong to society with prejudices. So you need to go there armed in a way that enables you to engage them in a way that they will understand you. Compassion is what's often lacking in NHS. Now, you can't evaluate compassion. People can learn it. Just like in the 80s, people learn empathy. When I started training as a postgraduate doctor, we didn't have empathy. We didn't know what empathy means. But with time, we discovered that you can train doctors to be empathetic. Now, people talk about empathy as if it's natural. It isn't. Some of us have it, some don't have it. So you can also teach people to understand other culture. I can go on and on about this. I think I should stop.
Thank you. Well, I think we've just about run out of time. So I think we need to start pulling things to a close now. I am aware that there's a number of questions that have not been answered. So what I'd like to suggest is that I work with each member of the panel afterwards, and we can answer the questions and then send out a document to all the people that attended today for those questions that we haven't managed to answer. Would that be all right, panel? Yes, all right, lots of nods. Thank you. And There's also been a comment come in about some of the terms, some of the jargon, and can there be an explanation of some of the things like intersectionality? So absolutely, we'll do that as well. Yeah, I think that's a good way forward. And one thing that's been asked a couple of times as well, if people don't self-identify as from BAME communities, what can they do to help? So that's just a question out to the audience. Feel free to put answers on the chat function or let us know afterwards. That will be great. Okay, so we will draw things to a close now. We will send out the slides. We will send out Ketan's paper. We will send out the recording, and we'll send out a note with a summary of the questions and answers. So just wanted to say thank you very much to our panelists, but thank you very much to everyone that joined and stuck with it. Thank you, it's been brilliant.